since he first came over to Australia from New Zealand in the early 1970s and adopted the persona Fred Dagg, John Clarke has been one of the leading voices in Australian comedy. Whether it's his weekly skewering of our politicians and public figures with the Clarke and Dore interviews, his work in film alongside Barry Humphries, Sam Neill and Paul Cox, or his classic TV series The Games, John Clarke has always been able to make us laugh. Now, just in time for the Rio Olympic Games, John Clarke's classic TV series The Games has just been re-released. It detailed the inner machinations of the organisation of the Sydney Olympic Games. And now, nearly 20 years after the show first went to air, it seems just as relevant as ever. John Clarke was our very special guest on Overnights.
Good morning, young man.
Thank you very much for your time. Look, it's so long, or it seems so long ago, that The Games was made. Do you remember a lot about the making of the show?
Well, it was a while ago, and it was a very compressed period. So, yes, I think once I unlock that particular part of my mind, it does all come back. I think largely because it was a slightly revolutionary idea, and I was working with fantastic people, so it was a wonderful memory of a fabulous collaboration.
So when you say a revolutionary idea, you're talking about the style in which it was made, that kind of documentary style which is now so prevalent, or what in particular?
Well, the business of mixing genres has been done since there were genres. We had our particular way of doing it. But the thing that appealed to me most about the newness of the idea was that, as distinct from a lot of television programs and particularly comedies, which are designed to not be about anything in particular, so you can run them, you know, out of order and you can run them in any country. We decided to write something about an event that was so particular and had a known date that the program could not run after that date. It was designed to deliver up to that date. The final episode went to air on the Monday of the opening ceremony, and we rather liked the idea that the rest of television and the rest of the news media would, as the event approached, increasingly promote our show.
And yet you made it at a time when releasing things on video was not unusual. DVDs were not that far away as well. Did you think it would have that second life that continues 16 years or 17, 18 years afterwards?
I think we probably did. We thought that its initial potency was in the fact it was about something and that we were creating an imaginary parallel universe, identical in some respects to the real universe, identical in time frame, for example. But no, we did think that if we got aspects of the human observation right, then the show should stand. And looking at it again recently, I find that there are parts of it that I can freely confess I found very amusing. I did have a lovely time doing it because I wrote it with a brilliant fellow called Ross Stevenson, who has the highest radio ratings in Melbourne's history and has had for nearly 20 years. He used to be a lawyer, and he's got a capacity, as well as being hilarious, to think structurally. So when we read in the paper that such and such was happening, he was very good at intuiting what would have happened before that and what was going to happen afterwards, whereas I was much more running on the spot trying to make the scenes work.
It seems, and this is obviously what you're aiming for, that it is all made up on the spot, that it's all improvised. How much was scripted and how much was improvised?
Well, virtually all of it was scripted. It was written slightly longer than we needed so that we could be in charge of the pacing of it by cutting it afterwards. It would benefit from something unexpected happening and some ad-libbing by all means, but we should have been able to do it with the flu and still have it work.
So also, you say, yes, well, you wanted to make it so specific about the Olympic Games, which were happening. And yet you watch it now and the Olympic Games is really incidental to it, that it's just a story of office politics.
Exactly right. And it's about human organisation, how we get on with one another, how in a workplace allegiances can be firm but can also shift, how sometimes people can be critical of one another but fiercely loyal, how a new person in a very familiar environment can be a plus or a minus depending on who they are and what the environment is. And yes, you're right, there's a picture of sport out the window, but we didn't go to any sporting events.
In fact, you make the point at one point, I think in the second series, where you say, well, that's the Seoul Olympic Stadium. That's not actually the Sydney Olympic Stadium.
That's right.
The whole show became very kind of, we'd call it very meta these days, when you started pretending, or not pretending, that this was a documentary, but you're actually saying, well, actually, no, we're just making a TV show here.
Yeah, that's right. We eventually got so bold, we decided to take all the walls down, including the ones inside our own brains. It got a bit surreal, but it was worth a crack.
It was ahead of its time with that documentary style, but were you influenced by anything else? I'm looking at something like, obviously, Yes Minister, where, again, it was about politics, but at the same time, it was the relationship between those three.
Well, Yes Minister is a beautifully written program, and yes, you're right. It's constructed around its arguments, not around its action. The action really is just how they're going to shoot it, whether Hacker should be sitting up or standing, you know, or whatever, and whether Appleby comes in with news or he goes to see Appleby. But the discussion is where the careful writing is, and it's absolutely beautiful, and it's very surreal, and that's why they're all wearing suits and looking as if they're genuinely in Whitehall. That's a pretty persuasive model. It's not the model we always used, but it's one of the things that's in the river we were drinking from, yes.
Yeah. And was it influenced by anything? I mean, when did you come up with the idea that it would have to be a documentary style?
Well, I thought that it would be good to do a comedy that doesn't have a laugh track, so it's sort of in denial about being a comedy. It's written as a satire and shot as a documentary, so that people will question the way they look at the rest of television and question whether or not, if it looks like a documentary, they are being manipulated or are they being told the truth. The form can be sufficiently persuasive that we need to be careful of it. So that's what I was trying to do there. And as to playing it as a drama, I didn't want to be slowing down for laughs. It's not really a gag-based show.
Yeah.
The humour is in its tone, in its observation of human relationships, and often in incidental things that are happening in the background.
So was there always the idea that there would be two series? Because it seems the second series is less reliant on that documentary style than the first one.
Yeah, that's right. And no, there wasn't. We started off doing a first series, and it was only when the first series worked that the ABC said they'd like a second. And I think by the time the second came around, we'd worked out our own performance rhythms, and they were beginning to dictate how we shot it rather than the other way around.
So was it always the idea that you'd just use your own names? What was the idea there?
Well, that was, again, something to do with, if we put as much non-fiction as we can marshal into this, we will mock the idea that non-fiction is truth and suggest that fiction might be sometimes closer to the truth than the over-prepared PR-based stuff that you're being served up a lot of the time. Even in the news is full of things that have been served up. I mean, if you want to read something interesting in the paper, write it. They're getting rid of their staff. They're desperate for material.
Very interesting. John Clark is our guest with one of the most distinctive voices in Australian television and film, and New Zealand TV and film for that matter.
Yeah, it is. We've tried everything. We can't fix that
Sorry. When did you first meet Brian Dawe?
I met Brian in 1987 when I was asked by ABC Radio, for whom I'd done a whole lot of Fred Dagg broadcasts in the late 70s, to go back and do some more radio. And I said, well, I really don't want to do monologues, so I'm very happy to come and talk about it, but I want to not do monologues. And here's the idea I would like to do. It's dialogues. And I went in and I got the head of radio comedy in Victoria to read the questions, and his name was Brian Dawe, and he was perfect.
And that's the same thing that you're doing today, basically.
It is. So I cast him immediately because his voice is very different from mine. He's got a very soft, concerned voice. He's got wonderful instinctive speech rhythms, Brian. And I thought, well, that's that problem solved. Fantastic. Then I got asked to do some monologues on television at Channel 9 initially, and I said, well, I'm happy to come and talk to you, but I don't want to do monologues. Here's what I want to do, and have you met Brian? So we started doing it on television in 1989, and we've been doing it ever since, which is a very long time.
And you did it for, what, 8 years or so on Channel 9 and then across
a few years,
ABC.
And then we went to the ABC.
So was there any difference between the two?
Not much, no. The idea is it's an exercise partly in form. We've adopted the language, the shot size. We're wearing suits. We've gone for looking as much like the people we're pretending to be, which we're also pretending not to be, as possible. And much is required of the audience. And the audience is fiercely smart, has a wonderful imagination, and has suspended disbelief for 27 years. And in a democracy, we are the people we're electing. It is government of the people. And, of course, actual professional politicians are now, and have for 30 years, been taking media lessons about how to pretend to be the people they're pretending not to be. So for us to go on and not to pretend to be the people we're pretending to be is a delicious irony.
Very interesting. The first episode of the Games, in fact, is about you getting media training from Barry Cassidy.
That's right, because we made a complete mess of a very big public press conference with the international media.
Mm.
Barry came and sorted us out and told us how to do that, how not to be. For example, don't waste your time answering the questions that you're allegedly there to answer. Kick on with what you want to say anyway.
And that's the first episode of the first series. Sort of the first episode of the second series is another, not exactly a press conference, but it's a staff conference.
Yes, and that's right.
So it's just, again, you going backwards and forwards, talking. This has got to be one of the wordiest TV shows in Australian history. It's
absolutely
all wordplay.
I'd say it would be the wordiest television program ever made in Australia. We talk all the time, and if we leave a gap, it's for a very good reason. Ross and I were both very interested in words. We both love sport. We had a hugely enjoyable time writing this series. Mm-hmm. And those actors are great. We had absolutely terrific actors. And you can only ask them to do that amount of material if they're absolutely brilliant performers, and they all were.
The Games is out on DVD. It's been out before, but there's a lovely box set in time for the Rio Olympics. So
yeah, they're going well.
Aren't they just? You would have had great material with the Rio Games. But one of the interesting differences, I suppose, between the artificial universe of the Games that you created and the real Games was that there was a problem every day on the Games, whereas it seems like the Sydney Olympics ran very smoothly.
Well, the Olympics themselves always work. The 3 weeks of the actual sport is always successful. It's very telegenic. It goes around the world. It's full of incredibly good-looking, very fit young people breaking world records. Why wouldn't that work? It's the part of the iceberg you can't see that's always problematic, and it contains all of the human folly that you can imagine. And it is also the case, I'm sure, with FIFA, with Eurovision, with the UN, with any of these large, as you say, meta organisations dealing with questions that are both general and specific at the same time.
We forget now how big SOCOG was in the news at the time. There was a story every single day about maybe something that was going wrong or something that was going right or the tickets or anything like that. Did you take those ideas or massage them a little bit and make them a bit different? Or did you find that some of the stories that you had written about were turning up in real life?
Well, we did find that some of the things that we imagined in a kind of Lewis Carroll world turned out to be completely true.
Yeah,
we were doing them as silly, but they did end up as non-fiction. I mean, imagine if you'd done a series about Brexit and you ended up with the wrong result.
Did you have people from SOCOG contacting you with suggestions?
We did. We did. And in those days, the principal means of leaking information to somebody would be to anonymously fax them. Our production office was in the offices that we shot the series in. So we would get in there and the set would be completely carpeted with faxes each morning from people who were shamelessly leaking from the organisation because they couldn't believe that, you know, such and such had just happened. We sometimes couldn't use that because it would have been far too obvious who had sent it to us and we would have imperiled somebody's job. But a lot of the time we were comforted by the fact that the sillier you imagine something, the closer to the truth you're going to end up being.
Were you surprised, even though as popular as the show was, that there were some moments in it that are still around in popular culture today, whether it be the length of the track, 97 metres, I think, or the argument about are you taking out the back three rows or the front three rows, the John Howard apology, the Seekers as well.
That's a very interesting question because, for example, the apology is not supposed to be funny. The episode is supposed to be funny and to set up the serious apology. The apology should be very effective in a quite conventional way for an apology to be. The point about that was that the Prime Minister, John Howard, refused to do it, so we got an actor, John Howard, to come in and solve the problem, which he did very generously and brilliantly, I might say. But a lot of the stuff that was comic, like the 100 metres track, that in a sense is a sketch which has found a home in a series. So something comic like that often does hang in the memory, and it doesn't date with time, and it should, you know, remain as well engineered now as it was at the time, if it was well engineered. And in that case, we had a brilliant actor playing Mr. Wilson, and it hummed like a top.
Had a lot of well-known people come through over the years, although not as many as you might have expected, perhaps. Did you have a lot of people saying, oh, I really want to be on this program?
We did have a couple of requests from people who imagined that if they were passing by, could they pop in? We tried to do, we had a pretty tight budget, so we couldn't afford to fly too many people in. But anybody who, you know, wanted to be in, if we could get them in without costing ourselves any money, they were very welcome and we were very grateful. But we did have three or four new cast members each episode, because quite a lot of that, as you said before, we've got a core cast, and into the office at the beginning of each episode walks two problems. And each of those problems has normally got a new cast member, and the key cast members are the same, so that the show is sort of both similar and different each week, because an audience wants to know what it's looking at. It wants to find a reliable form, an acceptable way of watching it, and their expectation needs to be delivered to, but they don't want to watch the same thing again. So a new problem needs to walk in, you know, the length of the swimming pools, this week's problem or something.
I remember also there was one episode with Dave Graney appeared, and he was a big star at the time, big music star.
He was, and he was very amusing.
He was, he barely said a word. I don't think he had a line of dialogue.
No, he just wanted to be it. He just wanted to be there in a hat, being Dave.
And then Johnny Farnham as well.
Yes, well, we asked Johnny Farnham, and he very kindly consented to do it. Sam Neill was in it because he happened to be in town and thought it was amusing. And
and you're an old mate of Sam Neill's.
Sam Neill and I go back a long way. Yeah.
How far do you go back?
I think we met when we were about sort of university anyway, that period. Yeah, we've known each other for a long time.
Why did you come to Australia from New Zealand in the first place?
Well, I'd been to Australia before, and I'd, you know, travelled to and fro quite a bit, and I'd begun to get offered some work, principally in ABC Radio. Robin Williams of The Science Show and Bob Hudson, who was on what was then Double J, had offered me work, and I came to Sydney to do that, and I did it with a great deal of interest, because what they were offering me was something slightly different from what I'd been doing in New Zealand, and so for a while I did both, and then I got very interested in the writing aspects of what I was doing in the Australian part of my career. And I eased my way towards that because it was my instinct that that was where I needed to go. And I'm very grateful that I did do that.
You also worked with Barry Humphries. Small roles, firstly in the first Barry McKenzie film, but also then in Les Patterson Saves the World. What's he like to work with?
Fabulous. The first, when I was in London, I was living in London in the, you know, early 70s, and I more or less accidentally got involved in the first Barry McKenzie picture. It was the first time I'd ever seen a camera. And Bruce Beresford, who was the director, and Don McAlpine, who was the camera operator, and Barry, who was the main other writer, and Barry Crocker, who was playing Barry McKenzie, were all extremely kind to me. You know, they invited me to go to Rush's and they spoke to me about how the film was being shot. They gave me an absolute lesson in the exercise we were all embarked upon. And I think they did that because they could just see that I was interested. I don't think anybody thought anything remarkable was happening. But I went back to New Zealand with a lot of that knowledge in my back pocket and thought, well, I sort of know a bit about how to do these things that I think I want to do. Just, you know, can I have a crack in the cockpit, please? Barry McKenzie film was made on the smell of an oily rag in London during a power strike. The only lights on in London were being made. I mean, there was a power strike right across England, and and the producers of the Barry McKenzie film went to France, hired a generator, took it back to England on a boat, and set it up so that we just didn't stop shooting. And I saw Barry do an interview with a program called Film 72. He was asked by the host, Joan Bakewell, why the film was being shot in London under these difficult circumstances. And Barry said, without blinking an eye, he said, well, the film is actually set in Calcutta, but London now looks so like Calcutta, and of course, it's so much cheaper.
Oh, dear. Dear, oh dear.
And I thought, you are a genius. You're dangerously clever. And he was. He was just he's a brilliant, brilliant person, Barry. If Barry were not a performer, he would have won prizes as a writer. And if he were not a writer, he would have won prizes as a performer. Yeah. But because he's both, he's just regarded as kind of a phenomenon.
Speaking of writing, you also worked with the late Paul Cox. Very sad to hear of his death. Tell me about your experience writing with him.
Well, Paul was a migrant to Australia from Holland. He was a filmmaker, a very well-known photographer. And Philip Adams had a film company at the time, and he wanted to make a film with Paul. He and Paul thought they needed somebody else to write another draft of it, perhaps with a little bit more emphasis on the dialogue and things. So I was asked to do this, and I met Paul, and Paul and I got on very, very well. And he'd already got the plot of the film worked out, so we were writing second and third and fourth drafts of it and so on, and it was a very interesting exercise for me to collaborate with somebody who was, in all sorts of ways, very different, but in all sorts of other ways, the film was about the human experience, and the human experience is common to us all. And we always stayed in touch after that film because it was a very successful film called Lonely Hearts. Paul went on to make a whole lot of other very successful films. And the last part of Paul's life was a particularly sad period, but it's also almost inspirationally exhilarating because he really might have died 7 or 8 years ago. He had a liver transplant. He got up out of palliative care about 6 months ago and decided he was going to America to speak at a film festival. Nobody thought he'd be able to do this who didn't know Paul, but those of us who knew Paul thought, well, stand well back, this is going to happen, because his willpower is gargantuan. And he went to Chicago, he attended the screening of his film, and he made a rather beautiful speech introducing it. And then he came back. Honor was satisfied. I think he was probably a bit exhausted. He sadly died, but nobody could say he didn't do what he wanted to do, that boy. He gave it a real good shake.
Had a wonderful obituary in the New York Times too.
Yes, there was. Excellent. And so there should have been. He was pretty remarkable.
So much of what you kind of predicted in the games came true, but perhaps none more so than the very final episode, the very final scene in the very final episode. Now, I don't want to spoil it for those who haven't seen the show, and I can't imagine there are too many, but they may not remember it, but it's a beautiful little tag to the whole series. When you began it, did you know how it was all going to finish?
No. Ross and I were writing about 2 episodes ahead of what we were shooting, and we were making an episode a week, and we could hardly have written that series way before shooting it because we were sometimes being responsive to events that were occurring as we were working. So we wrote the last episode while we were probably in the last couple of weeks before the Olympics began.
So all the things that had happened right up to that point kind of informed, created that last scene.
Yeah, that's right. And it was obvious too that because of the large amount of organisation that had to go into the Sydney Olympics, and because of the skills that some of the key people had acquired during that experience, they were going to be in huge demand at Athens, for example, and in London and so on. So that perhaps what these people were doing in achieving something in allegedly a one-off kind of world, what they were actually doing was securing their own future.
Indeed. But isn't it the case though that every Olympics since then, either the summer or the winter, is basically modelled on the template that Sydney started with? The opening ceremony and the closing ceremony are basically just copies of what Sydney did.
That's right. And they're very often produced by the same people who did them in Sydney.
Exactly. Did you watch any of the games? Did you go to any events?
No, but I watched it avidly. I like sport, and a couple of years ago I did a documentary about Australia's interest in sport, and I met a lot of prodigiously talented Australian sports people from a wide range of different disciplines and locations, and it was one of the most fascinating projects I've ever been involved with. It was a huge privilege for me to talk to those people, and what they said was absolutely remarkable, because it became obvious when we spoke to them that a lot of what they did in sport was about sport, but a lot of it wasn't. It's about who you are.
It was a great series. I did enjoy that as well.
It was a real thrill for me to meet those people, and they were really fantastic.
Recently, also, you've appeared in the movie A Month of Sundays with...
I have, yes. I'm afraid that couldn't be avoided. I had to do
really?
That.
Really? Playing a real estate agent in a lovely little movie, a really beautiful little film.
I did that film because Matthew Saville, who wrote and directed it, I know his work. I've worked in on previous occasions with Matthew, and he's a wonderful filmmaker. He's also a very busy television director. He directs Please Like Me. He's directed all sorts of other series.
The movie about Graham Kennedy as well.
Yeah, that's right. He's directed all sorts of things. So I know and like Matthew, and the other people in the film were all going to be terrific. I'd never met Anthony LaPaglia before, but he was just great to watch, a really world top flight film actor. Basically, he has to carry the film. He's in almost every scene, and he's got to play something that's very hard to play because his character is having a kind of interior psychological crisis, and he's feeling a bit sorry for himself, and he's a bit of a sad sack. And Anthony has to make that clear while being appealing enough for us to be interested in the outcome of his kind of internal crisis. And Julia Blake, who I think will probably win a prize for her brilliant performance in this film, she's the one who offers him a road out of his rather bleak view of himself.
It's a really lovely movie. John, thank you very much. You know, I'm sure you look back proudly on the games, even after all this time. What a fabulous TV show it was. How, even though you say you weren't really playing it for laughs, it wasn't with a laugh track and all that, but there are so many funny scenes in it, and thank you so much for telling us about it again.
Well, thank you very much. Comedy doesn't have a better friend than drama, and that's what we were trying to do, and thank you for your kind thoughts.
That is John Clark talking about his life, his career, and the classic TV series The Games, which is now available in a special 2-season edition from ABC Shop Online and in all good DVD stores.